This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Austin, back up somehow. Uh-oh, Austin ducked it. Austin going for the stunner, and Michaels countered. Michaels going for another kick. Austin, he got it! The stunner! Mike Tyson in! Austin is the champion! Stone Cold! Stone Cold! Stone Cold!
Wait a minute! Tyson and double cross the end!
Hey everybody, welcome to another edition of Place to Be Nation's WrestleMania Rewind. If you're not accustomed to my voice, if you are a regular listener of the Place to Be podcast, my name is Ben Morse. I am a semi-regular to regular on Place to Be Main Event podcast. I've been a guest in the past, and I am honored to be hosting the WrestleMania 14 edition of this, the brainchild of one Stephen Graham, and something we've all been enjoying a lot. Luckily for you, I do have a very familiar voice joining me. You guys have all heard him on 300 episodes almost at this point of Place to Be podcast, on Place to Be Main Event. He is the host on Place to Be Extra Point. Just all over the place, and that is my good, longtime, close, personal friend and one of my favorite people, Scott Criscolo.
I like being introduced by you, Ben. That's yeah, right? I enjoy that. The feeling is definitely mutual. It's always good to talk to you. This is a special show. It's nice to be on a show with a kind of a different spin.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, I've been on one already so far. I was on the WrestleMania 4 Rewind special with me, Parv, from Where the Big Boys Play, Rich, and Steven.
Yes, as I call it, the Parv and Friends edition.
Yes.
The WrestleMania Rewind.
Yes, Parv and
Friends. I've never spoken to you, Parv. I'm a big fan, but yeah, man, you own that one.
Yeah, he did. He did. He had all the he had Meltzer's Black Book, and
it was pretty incredible.
And it would have got it whatever else. This has been a great series, and I hope you've enjoyed it. And with WrestleMania 30 around the corner coming up on April 6th in New Orleans, which of course you will be at, Ben.
And I will.
I am extremely jealous because I was of course at WrestleMania 29
as
last
was I.
year, as were
I
you.
Was there. Yep.
And you didn't come to the tailgate.
I'm I know.
Half upset. You didn't come to the tailgate.
You know, it was so soon. I was just barely getting to know you guys.
Yeah.
I had my wife and a bunch of friends with me, so I didn't venture in, but certainly, you know, hopefully it will happen again in the future.
Yep.
I'll definitely be there next time.
You won't be coming to Extreme Rules, huh?
I don't know if I'm going to be at Extreme Rules or not. It's still up in the air, but if I'm there, we're definitely going to
we've got a small
exchange
crew for
pleasantries.
That. No,
yes.
Definitely have a small crew for that. Myself, yeah. The doctor will be coming, Mr. Woodling.
Yeah,
and but let's not date ourselves. We'll get to that another day.
All right. Well, speaking of shows that I've attended, that segues into what we're doing here today.
Aha. Uh-huh.
As you said, we're talking about WrestleMania. If you guys haven't heard the first couple of installments, obviously go back and listen to you guys did WrestleMania 4. I know Justin Rosero and some of the other guys did WrestleMania 7.
Yep.
Both went great. But the subject of today's podcast. And it's going to be a little different, a little special, because Scott and I are, as you can probably tell at this point, we're alone. It's just the two of us.
Just the two of us.
I'll be coming back with some other guys after the break. We're recording this in two parts.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about WrestleMania 14 from my hometown of Boston, Massachusetts. I was there live at the Fleet Center.
I was not there. I wish I was.
In 1998, yeah. We're going to be getting into all this. It's a pivotal WrestleMania. Scott, you and I were talking about before we started the show tonight. You were saying this was really a make-or-break show for the WWF. Maybe not to the extent of WrestleMania 1 where everything was on the line, but this was the first show, a lot of people would say, of the Attitude Era. It was coming off the Montreal Screwjob. It was in the midst of WCW dominating for several years. So why don't you go a little further and set the stage for where we were as we rounded out of 1997 headed into 1998 for what would prove to be one of the most pivotal WrestleManias in the 30-year history.
Well, obviously, Ben, we were coming up on the cusp of Montreal and what happened at the 1997 Survivor Series and the screw job and Brett leaving and a lot of people leaving and just the bad taste that World Wrestling Federation fans had in their mouth for what happened that night. WCW had a sliver opening. And that was, of course, their signature pay-per-view was coming up next, and that was, of course, Starrcade in Washington, D.C., and that, of course, was the huge main event of Hollywood Hogan defending the WCW world title against Sting. If that was executed properly, you and I may not be talking right now. Well, we would be. We'd be talking about something else.
Right. We'd be talking about Starrcade 2014.
Exactly.
Coming up in 8 months.
In 8 months. Yeah, I know. I always thought that was fucked up. Their biggest show was in Christmas, but I guess
it was weird. Yeah,
it was supposed to be Thanksgiving, but you know,
sure.
But WWF found their way to push that around in the '80s. But in any event, that was half executed because they couldn't do that right with the whole Bret Hart run in and Hogan actually won clean, and that was a shit show. Having said that, then WWF had their In Your House D-Generation X pay per view, which was in close to your hometown. Close to mine as well, Ben, in Springfield, yeah. Mass, at the old Civic Center,
yeah.
Which is now the Mass Mutual Center, which is a dump. I think it's been renovated, though. And that pay-per-view was just fucking hideous.
Right. That was definitely the, all right, we've just come off Montreal, we don't quite have a plan, but we need to put on a show, so here's what we've got.
Right.
There was not... Whether or not, and this is something we'll get into, whether or not they had the blueprint there, obviously they weren't ready to start unveiling it quite yet.
No. And the show was not good. The Shawn Michaels-Ken Shamrock main event was it just was not a very good show. So as we head into 1998, things in pro wrestling were kind of in flux. WCW was still going strong. They did not hit a home run at Starrcade like they needed to, so they gave the World Wrestling Federation a little life as they headed into 1998. But WWF, as low as things were, as screwed in the head as Shawn Michaels was at the time, the WWF had one shining star, one key they could put in the lock and open the door to victory in the Monday Night War. And that golden key was named Stone Cold Steve Austin. Guy was over like he was as cool as the other side of the pillow, and he was over like you wouldn't believe.
Now, of course, the transition there was they had Stone Cold. They had everything in place. We get the Royal Rumble, much stronger pay-per-view. I think you probably agree.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Interestingly enough, there was still one more piece to be put in for WrestleMania, and it was not what I was expecting, I have to say, the final element of the main event at WrestleMania.
Mm-hmm.
But that was at the Royal Rumble, or at least a little bit before the Royal Rumble, they announced that Mike Tyson was going to be at the Royal Rumble,
mm-hmm.
and that on Raw the next night they would reveal his role in WrestleMania. Yep. Now, what was your reaction, Scott, when you heard that Mike Tyson? Because you got to remember, putting this in context, this was Mike Tyson after he'd been in jail for several years. Mm-hmm. He had come back. He had had a couple fights. This was post biting Evander Holyfield's ear.
Mm-hmm.
He was not the Mike Tyson they tried to get back in, what was it, 88, 89, when Buster Douglas beat him and he was supposed to be on Saturday Night's Main Event.
That was February 90.
Oh,
it was literally
right, so
like
90.
A month. It was literally like a month later. That Buster Douglas was on that main event. I think it was Hogan defending the title against Savage. And it was like, wow, Buster Douglas.
Yeah.
It was like so flat, you know.
So this was not Tyson in his prime, Tyson the undefeatable world champ. This was Tyson the fallen star, basically, the disgraced icon. So what was your reaction when you found out Mike Tyson was going to be part of this? Did you think it would be the needle mover that it ended up being?
I think it had to be, Ben. I think it had to be because, first of all, Mike Tyson was a longtime wrestling fan. As you've heard, as we've heard in other DVDs and other video clips, he was a big Bruno Sammartino fan as a kid. He grew up in the Bronx, or Brooklyn. He grew up in Brooklyn, trained in the Catskills. So he had that Northeast influence, and he knew of wrestling, and he knew Bruno. So he had an idea. But again, he was in jail for something, whether he did commit or didn't commit, was dumb enough to get caught in it. And then, of course, where he tried to get back in the groove and then had the bad, the ear biting with Holyfield. He was a shit show at this point.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people were thinking, what does Vince have to lose right now? The company is not in the best of shape. Morale is low. We are fresh off of Brett leaving. I don't think they had anything to lose at this point. So I thought that bringing in Mike Tyson was actually not a bad idea, and it was just a question of what to do. If he was going to wrestle, I don't know if that would have been a stellar idea.
Right, which a lot of people thought he would.
Yes.
But I do agree that, you know what, they got the better Mike Tyson in a way than they would have gotten in 1990 because they had the notoriety. Mm-hmm. This blew up everywhere. People who may have started watching more recently, people who weren't watching at the time, may not have the context of just how wide of coverage this got. These days, you know, with crossover stars like The Rock and things like that, you'll see wrestling get mainstream coverage pretty frequently. Other sports stars very much into them. We'll see stuff like that. But even then, in 97, I would say even when WCW, as big as it was, they did not get the kind of media attention WWF got when they announced that Mike Tyson, one of the most infamous figures on the planet.
And I was the only wrestling fan of the bunch.
Right.
My co-host Mike, who actually now is a wrestling fan, he's the one whose house I go to every year, and I've gone to his house almost every month for the last 15 years on Sundays for pay-per-view. He laughed at me that I was watching it, but I said, you know what? Tonight's huge, guys. Mike Tyson's going to be on Raw.
Right.
And they're like, this is how low he sunk. I'm like, telling you guys, just watch. And sure enough, Tyson comes out. A little trivia for you, Ben.
Mm.
When Vince asked him who his two favorite wrestlers were, do you remember what he said?
One was Bruno.
Yep.
I remember that.
Yep.
It was someone else of that era, right?
Yes.
It was another older guy. I want to say Killer Kowalski, but I don't think so.
No, not that old.
Not that old.
No.
Wasn't Billy Graham, was it?
No, it wasn't Billy Graham.
Another heel.
Yeah.
In that era.
70s through the late 80s, yeah.
Iron Sheik?
Close. His tag team partner.
Nikolai Volkov. That's great.
Pretty sad.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Bruno and Nikolai,
what a combo.
The two pillars of the early WWF.
Yes. Before That's the crazy. Wide was dumped.
Yeah, right.
So Tyson comes out and Vince is all happy and everything, and just as he's about to announce what's going down on March 29th, the glass breaks. And what you have is probably one of the most important 5 or 6 minutes in WWF history. And that's the whole promo when he goes, I got a little sign language, so here's to ya. And then he flips him off, Tyson's pissed, shoves him, and then chaos.
Yeah.
And that is all that was in every newspaper the next morning. USA right. Today, local papers here in Connecticut, I'm sure, Ben, where you were, in Mass.
Sure, yep, in the Globe, in the Herald, everywhere.
Yep, and Vince probably was like, I did it again. I think I might have saved myself here.
Right.
What were your thoughts on that? That was a big deal. I mean, that's huge.
It was huge.
Because 3 years ago, he tried with Lawrence Taylor.
Right.
But there was a difference. That roster was fucking putrid. so was the product, to be honest with you.
But you know what else it was, Scott? It was symbolic, and what you said was right on about how important this moment was. It was symbolic that Vince was willing, finally, after years, to change with the times.
Yep.
It is something that we had seen not take root in 96, not take root in 97. It was all about Vince trying to keep up with WCW when WCW was changing the rules,
right,
when ECW was becoming big, mm-hmm, when anti-heroes were starting to rise. That's why Austin got over in the first place. And the Lawrence Taylor move was, you know, the typical bring a celebrity, he's a superhero, treat him as a star, have him feud with a bad guy. This was different. This was your main good guy getting in the face of your valued guest just because he wanted to prove that he was the baddest MF-er on the planet.
Right.
And that was the difference. That was the moment that you saw Vince, and especially, you know, with a guy like Mike Tyson who had just come out of jail, Vince was willing to get dirty. Because that's what he was not willing to do up to this point.
Right.
He was going to try to win with the old Hulk Hogan method. How many years in the 90s did he spend trying to build himself another Hulk Hogan?
Can you say Diesel?
Exactly. Yep. But this was Vince saying, I'm going to start listening to the people who have my ear at that time, Shane, Vince Russo, starting to say, all right, the CCW thing seems to be picking up. Mm-hmm. WCW is winning because they have the NWO and everyone loves that they're badasses. All right, let's get dirty. And that would end up being, in many ways, the theme of WrestleMania was, you know, this is the new WWF. This is the Attitude Era. They introduced the Attitude campaign back in Background Survivor Series. They had that great promo during Survivor Series where, you know, this is who I am, this is what I do. That had to be edited a million times every time people left the company or got injured.
Yeah. So it went from like 2 minutes to like 45 seconds.
Well, yeah, because that first one had Brett finishing up, and then immediately the next night it was changed to Sean, and then a couple weeks later, Austin. It was a great promo, but it definitely fell apart. But yeah, no, now you have him saying, all right, you know, guys like Austin, DX, this is how I'm going to beat WCW. And Mike Tyson is the ultimate representation of the weapon I'm going to use to beat WCW.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So we move forward. We go to No Way Out of Texas, where, again, kind of a forgettable show.
Yeah.
Just, you know, really all the eggs are going towards the WrestleMania basket at this point. It's all build up. And that's something I want to talk to you about is that, you know, I'm going to get into, with the other guys, the specifics of the matches, of the moments, things like that. But, you know, watching WrestleMania 14 back, we talked about this a little while ago. It's not a great wrestling show at all.
No.
The Austin Michaels match is probably Shawn Michaels' worst WrestleMania match. The rest of the show, very quick matches, very garbagey. I remember being there in the crowd. You couldn't have told me that. I thought this was Great American Bash 89, you know, just because of the intensity. But the reason for that to me is that we're talking about it here, the build-up to Steve Austin winning the title. Not even so much the Steve Austin-Shawn Michaels feud, because let's be honest, there wasn't much of a feud. It was more Steve Austin winning the big one. Mm-hmm. Mike Tyson, what's he going to do? And we'll get into a sec what Tyson's role ended up being.
Right.
But between that, between Undertaker and Kane, their story, the tag title match, that had months and months of buildup. It was kind of a bridge from the old WrestleManias to the new WrestleManias. You know, those initial WrestleManias basically had a story behind the main event, maybe a couple other matches, then just a bunch of matches thrown together. These days, everything gets built in the last month.
Mm-hmm.
But 14, and I would argue it lasted a couple more years, there was really a golden age of every match on this card has been percolating since at least the early winter, maybe the fall, in some cases, you know, almost a full year. That Undertaker-Kane match, the seeds were planted 11 months earlier. Okay. When Undertaker threw a fireball in Paul Bearer's face.
Yeah.
So what would you say to that, the fact that, you know, WrestleMania 14, when it ranks among the all-time greats, may not be the best wrestling card, may not be the greatest spectacle. I mean, you know, I love the Fleet Center, but it's no stadium.
No.
But in terms of build, just one of the most well-built WrestleManias of all time.
I can't disagree with you on that, Ben. I mean, you've got a... Kane was starting to be mentioned by Paul Bearer in, what, July?
Yeah.
You know, maybe even late June, early July.
Yeah.
Austin, well, you can argue that it was building for him at King of the Ring 96, technically.
Sure.
If you want to have that foresight. But the problem we had was the health of Shawn Michaels. Now, he was supposed to be at No Way Out of Texas.
Right.
In that eight-man tag. And I bet you Shawn would have won that match.
I think
Shawn's side would have won that match to kind of build a little – some kind of intrigue without it being a foregone conclusion that Austin was going to win March 29th in Boston. Then, of course, he wakes up one morning and he can't move. And we all remember, if you look very vividly at what happened at the Royal Rumble, and you see it on the – they had put it on the don't try this at home the last couple of years.
Yeah.
At the Rumble in the casket match, Taker backdrops Shawn over the top rope. I think Shawn was supposed to clear the casket, which was sitting next to the apron, but just misses it, and his lower back, right above his ass, rams one of the hinges of the casket. When you look at it, you're thinking, oh, he bumped his back. Well, apparently he tore the shit out of a disc, and that was that. So all of a sudden, Shawn's not at No Way Out of Texas. So as awesome as that build was getting, Ben, where the fuck is the champion?
Yeah.
Now, we know Shawn is kind of a flake, but to not show up for a pay-per-view? Nah, something's wrong. And he was replaced by one of the worst replacements ever, and that was Savio Vega. Remember that stretch, Ben? And Justin and I talk about this all the time on the Place to Be podcast. Every right. surprise guy for about 2 years was going to be Randy Savage.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Every surprise guy was Savage leaving that. WCW. So there was a little issue with the main event, at least, about his health, Shawn's health, and how good that match was going to be if he even was going to do it. Now, as for the rest of the card, Owen Hart, let's talk about him for a minute.
Yeah.
Owen Hart, and you'll get, and of course, Ben, you'll get into more of the matches with Chad Campbell and the rest of the guys in the next segment. But we want to talk about Owen Hart for a minute because he was siphoned off of Shawn Michaels. Because remember what happened at In Your House DX after the loss to or after beating – Ken Shamrock, or was it DQ?
I think he lost to him by DQ.
Yeah, it was DQ. Yeah. Owen runs in, and he was beating the shit out of Shawn behind them. He was potatoing the fuck out of him.
And Owen was red hot.
He was red hot.
And I remember there was a lot of speculation early in 98 that we would see a double main event at WrestleMania of Owen Shawn and Austin Tyson.
Which... that would have been a disaster.
Yeah.
That would have been poor Austin. What the fuck would he – so with that – so here's a good interesting question. Would Owen have won the Rumble? I don't think Austin was just too hot.
I don't buy that that was ever the plan.
I don't think that was ever the plan either.
I think it's wishful thinking on the part of people who would have – who wanted to see, you know, Owen get hit.
I'm wondering if the original Royal Rumble title match was Austin – was Shawn Owen.
Instead of a third
Shawn Taker match.
That's intriguing.
I wonder if it was supposed to be Owen and Shawn at the Royal Rumble. Now, would that have affected the build for Austin and Shawn? No, probably not. I mean, you know, the Rumble was different. Austin was winning the Rumble at the time, the match itself.
Sure.
So I'm curious to see what the guys think of that.
That's definitely something we're going to have to get into, the role of Owen Hart, who did end up on the card wrestling Triple H for the European
He was just siphoned to the other DX guy.
Exactly.
Triple H was nothing more than mid-card guy. He was a European champion. It was handed to him at that Christmas Raw in
it was in Lowell, Massachusetts. That was actually pretty much my home base.
There you go.
The Songhees Center.
Songhees Center.
Used to love it because it was tiny, so there was no bad seats.
It was almost like Hammerstein, right?
Yeah, it was very much like Hammerstein. I went to
when I call it my home base, it was really, you know, I went to a couple shows there. But I went to two shows there. One was a house show, and not to get too off track, but you know, hey, this is our podcast. We're telling our story.
Exactly. It all correlates.
I went to a house show in 96 where it was during a European tour, which obviously I didn't know that at the time. Mm-hmm. So me and my buddies went to a house show, very excited to go to it. Turns out most of the roster's over in Europe. We got to see such stellar matches as Furnace and LaFon against the Grimm Twins. I remember Dr. X was on the card.
Oh, God.
The Smoking Guns wrestled each other, which I will always remember simply for the fact that Bart Gunn was the only person who we were right on the entranceway. He was the only person who gave us a high five the entire night.
Nice.
So instantly we became Bart Gunn fans. What nice. I do remember is that the main event was Sean, who had just lost the title to Sid. He didn't go on the European tour. Wrestled Goldust, and it was one of the best matches I'd ever seen.
Right.
It was just awesome. Sean, you know, just having a great house show match. And the other time I went there was Thursday Raw Thursday.
Ah, yes, February 13th, 1997.
When Sean lost his smile, I was there in the crowd. And I actually almost made it onto TV because at the end of that show, Steve Austin comes down the balcony to taunt Bret Hart, and he comes down our aisle. My buddy Dave is literally standing next to Stone Cold. They keep cutting to him, and where am I? Standing next to him holding a sign in front of my face.
Ah, you schlub.
So I could have been immortalized. Instead, I am behind a sign. But yeah, regardless, that was Christmas Raw from the Songa Center. Love that place.
That's awesome. That's awesome. It's still standing, right?
I'm not sure. You know, it wasn't it was not primarily a wrestling venue. It was mostly a convention center.
Right.
More of a, you know, a place where they would have political rallies. So I'd have to check up on that, but I can't imagine. Yeah, they never tear anything down in Lowell, so I'm sure it's still there.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Yeah. Then you were getting the build of the Outlaws, and they needed an opponent.
Right.
And then you started saw, of course, the flip from Mankind, and then in September he became Cactus Jack, and he went back to Mankind a little bit, but then he went back to Cactus Jack in December and January.
It was Dude Love in December. I mean, there was actually a bit where this feud started in December as well, because the Outlaws beat up Dude Love one week. He came back the next week as Mankind. They beat up Mankind. They locked him in a fridge. That was also the Christmas Raw. And that was when, for the first time in a couple months, he brought back Cactus, and he was going to be the guy to feud with the Outlaws, and he needed a partner, and I'll let you pick it up from there.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, a chainsaw comes through a big wooden box.
Yes.
And out comes a guy with pantyhose on his head. And everybody knew, unless you were like 11, everybody knew that it was Terry Funk.
Yeah.
And they called him Chainsaw Charlie. And I'm thinking to myself, why didn't he just be Terry Funk? Who the fuck cared? Now, the rumor was that Vince was still pissed off at Funk over something he did in 93 where he was supposed to show up to an event and then left him a note saying I had to go tend to my cows or my horses or some weird thing. So Vince said, all right, fine, but I'm going to fuck with you and put a pantyhose on your head and become Chainsaw Charlie.
But damn if he didn't get into it.
Yeah, that's a word. Terry Funk's the kind of guy you're never going to punish because he's always going to do make chicken shit out of chicken salad or whatever the hell that stupid phrase is.
Pretty sure it's the other way around unless you want to
chicken salad out of chicken shit. I thought it was the reverse Midas touch. Everything you touch is turned.
Yeah, right. Unless you want to have a chicken shit sandwich for lunch.
Chicken shit sandwich.
That's backwards.
Yes. So you have that feud percolating. And then you have the Triple H Owen Hart now, as Owen Hart's suddenly been siphoned to Triple H because Sean's scared of him.
Yep.
And, you know, Vince did whatever Sean asked at that time.
Yeah.
That didn't end 3 years earlier with the with the click. Then, of course, the other big match was The Undertaker and Kane.
Right.
Now, the Rock-Shamrock feud was pretty much already organic, had already been building, and you know, they just came. Back then, rematches at WrestleMania, I can contend, and I've talked about this with Justin and I have talked about it on the Place to Be podcast, that WrestleMania didn't get that specialty show feeling till probably 17. Now you would not see rematches from an earlier pay-per-view. Absolutely not.
No.
But Shamrock and Rock fought at the Rumble. Nah, fuck it. Nah, wrestle at WrestleMania.
Yeah.
Rematch. You never saw it. You'll never see that now.
No.
And so that match, that feud was organically built. So as No Way Out in Texas ended, really the only thing in limbo was Sean's health in that main event. Now, the whole story about him not putting Austin over, we don't hear about that for another, like, 10 years before
right.
that ever comes to light. Maybe a little earlier. Did you have any doubt at this point that Austin was going to be the guy that was going to, you know, that there was no doubt that he was going to beat Sean?
No, I think it was a foregone conclusion back when that was a good thing. Back when WrestleMania meant the guy who you wanted to see win the title was going to win the title. We saw it at 13 with The Undertaker.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that was kind of a thrown together show, it was what people wanted to see.
Right.
We definitely saw it at 12 with Shawn. That was what they'd been building up to for a year. And, you know, going back before that, it was WrestleMania was the show where the top face in the company won the title. And
right.
that was fine. But like you said, the big question mark was Shawn going to make it?
Mm-hmm.
And what was Tyson's role going to be? Because at this point, we knew Tyson was going to be there, but I'm not sure on the exact timeline. By the time No Way Out had come around, had he made his turn yet, so to say?
Because
I feel like it was between No Way Out and WrestleMania that Tyson joined DX.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Yes, that was on the... Let me see what Herb has.
Sure.
Let's go to... I bet you it was like... well, the pay-per-view was the 15th, so let's do like the 26th.
I know it wasn't too late. They had a lot of time to run with it.
Yeah.
And I do think that was kind of their... All right, well, if Sean can't be here to further the feud, at least we got Tyson. Tyson as part of DX was the feud more than anything else.
And it was cool.
It was very cool,
yeah.
And you know what? That was the first, if you want to really look at it, that was the first example of the crowd was not behind Tyson, so they made him a heel. We've seen it in recent years where, you know, either a wrestler will come back or a celebrity will come in, and they will try to shove him down our throats no matter what. Like, this guy's going to be a babyface. We don't care what you're saying.
It was the March 2nd Raw.
Okay,
so
wow,
it
so it was
26 days before the show.
All right.
So on the March 2nd Raw is when Sean ripped the shirt and Tyson's, and it was revealed he was with DX, which I thought was just cool. That was just cool.
It was great. It was great, and it was playing off what was already going on with the crowd, where they didn't like Tyson. He was a guy from outside of wrestling. I don't think the crowd ever bought that he was legit, even though he was a legit fan, as we know. But the crowd never bought him. Putting him in that role with DX was great. It added for the casual crowd that wrinkle that maybe Austin won't win. Those of us who were, you know, hardcore wrestling fans knew how it was going to go down.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were tuning in because of Tyson, which a lot of people were, and that's what Vince was banking on, when you see Tyson join DX and you turned on to see what Tyson was going to do, you're thinking, oh, wow, Austin, this Stone Cold guy is screwed. You know, Tyson's the referee, which was another wrinkle.
Mm-hmm.
He was the referee for the match. Ended up being the outside enforcer, but I think they kind of cleverly didn't get into specifics on that until the night of WrestleMania.
Precisely.
But yeah, you thought, all right, well, this guy's screwed. I guess the good guy's going to lose.
Precisely. That's pretty much what it was set up to be.
Yeah.
So as we were getting into March, you had your card set. Now, when did you buy your tickets?
That's interesting because we initially, you know, I was still in high school at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have as much freedom to, you know, get to wrestling as I wanted. I couldn't get tickets easily and all that. So I went to try to get tickets and they were already sold out. So I didn't think I was going to WrestleMania. I was hoping to go with a big group of my friends. All of us went to, I think it was there was a Ticketmaster in the Filene's near our house. So we go there. They're sold out. We didn't know any better. You know, we didn't know how quickly WrestleMania tickets sold out. We'd only gone to a few shows.
Right.
About 2 or 3 weeks before WrestleMania, one of my best friends calls me and says, "Hey, this guy who works with my dad has 3 tickets to WrestleMania." So it ends up being me and 2 of my friends literally within under a month of the show, thinking we were just going to be sitting at home watching on pay-per-view. We end up with pretty decent seats, not, you know, lower level or anything, but good visibility seats to WrestleMania. So it was not, to answer your question, I did not get them very early. It was definitely a last minute thing. So it was like a cool surprise for me almost that I ended up being there because I didn't think I was going to be.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, yeah. I didn't make it to Boston that day. All right. It is time for me to pass the baton.
Yes.
So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, Ben will be joined by Chad Campbell from Where the Big Boys Play. And who knows, maybe some other surprises. Not quite sure.
Yeah, hopefully more than Chad. We'll see. Because you and I
talk
you,
like Parv then.
Yeah. Well, you and I can do a whole segment alone. Me and Chad, I've seen how that ends. If anyone's, you know, if anyone's ever listened to the Brad and Chad show, we did it once and it wasn't pretty. So,
oh god,
fingers crossed. But
all right, you Scott, are listening.
Yeah, Scott, thanks for joining me for this segment.
Oh, of course, absolutely. You're listening to the WrestleMania Rewind series here on the Place to Be Podcast Network, Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. This is WrestleMania 14. Ben will be back to talk more about the WrestleMania that saved the company, March 29th, 1998, in Boston, WrestleMania 14. We'll be back right after this.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out The Kevin Kelly Show each and every week, placetobenation.com. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today, plus be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here, placetobenation.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You probably definitely listened to part one if you got this far, so we thank Scott for doing that part. But now I got a new crew, new support staff. Or maybe I'm the support staff. I don't know. Anyways, we've got the North-South connection with us. We got from our neighbors. I'm trying to think of a way to say not neighbors to the north because I just said north. But there's no way. Anyways, he's a great guy. He was on Place to Be Nation's main event recently. He is Aaron George. Aaron, how you doing, buddy?
I'm great, man. My ego's taking a bit of a hit with the Adrian Adonis reference, but it's good. It's good.
Don't assume you're necessarily Adrian Adonis, you know? This is 2014. The directions don't mean anything anymore.
North-south paradigm is finished, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah. Up is down, down is up. Got but the southern part of that equation, southern gentleman himself, longtime veteran of Where the Big Boys Play, host of the venerable Brad and Chad show. Chad side of that equation, and that's Chad Campbell. Hey, Chad.
I guess if Aaron is Adrian Adonis, I could be Uncle Elmer, and we could reenact the WrestleMania 2 match.
Nice. Yeah, no, that'd be a great use of our time.
Yeah.
A great use of everyone's time.
Let's break that down hold for hold.
Yeah, all right, cool. So you guys tuned in to listen to WrestleMania 14, but so we're going to take a little trip in the Wayback Machine and go back to 1986, talk about Adrian Adonis, Uncle Elmer. But guys, welcome to the show. Have either of you done any of the rewinds so far?
I have not. This is my maiden voyage.
Not me too.
All right, so we're rookies. We're going at it. Anyways, Scott and I, in the first part of this podcast, broke down kind of the build to WrestleMania 14, and now we're going to get into the show itself. Before we get into the matches or anything like that, just going to ask you guys. I was there. I was there live at the Fleet Center in Boston. We heard the story of how I got there in the first part. Were you guys watching this at home? Did you watch it live? Did you get a chance to check it out after the fact? We'll go reverse order and start with Chad.
One thing that I think is kind of interesting for me and the attitude error overall is me living where I did, there was still a big WCW contingency, even into like 1999. So while I was starting to kind of watch WWF somewhat during the Austin era and his rise up the card, I was still predominantly a WCW fan, and that would actually carry over into really mid-1999. So this show I did not watch live. I did get the VHS and rent that when it came out. I know I was pretty hyped coming in just because of the Mike Tyson thing, but it was a show that, like, I wasn't nostalgic for as a child. I was 12 years old when the show happened. And it also wasn't a show where, now that I see the whole card kind of composed and have looked back in wrestling history and see how a lot of these matches have been built to, I didn't get that sense at the time. I was aware of kind of the main event and the Undertaker-Kane build, but besides that, I was pretty spotty on the rest of the undercard.
Interesting. So definitely a different perspective. That's cool. And we'll talk more about kind of the build and the importance of the card overall. But first, before we get to that, Aaron, what were you doing back in 1998? Where were you as far as being a wrestling fan?
Well, we had just come out of this thing called the Ice Storm. It's like shut down our power for like 6 weeks. And that's actually no joke. Yeah, it was hell. I watched.
Yeah, they get like 3 flakes of snow and they shut down the city.
Yeah. It's. Anyway.
Did you see the pictures?
Yes, I did.
I was in the middle of a
live skit where they made fun of you guys. I didn't see the actual. That's my news source. So
that was the worst ride of my life. four and a half hours to go 32 miles, but that's another story for another day.
What was it raining or something?
It was a little ice, Ben.
Yeah. Anyways, back to Aaron.
I actually watched this live, but scrambled. You know what I mean? That blue, like.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So I watched it live scrambled, but yeah, I'm actually kind of an interesting counterpoint to Chad, because like up north in Canada, like, we barely got WCW at all, like, until about 97, 98. So WWF was everything. So this was us, like, coming. Like, on the internet, we'd hear about WCW is great, but this was like, yeah, we're coming. We're finally back in this thing now, you know? So I was super excited about the build, about the show, about everything. I just had a girlfriend at the time who didn't want to watch wrestling, so.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's the worst.
And that girlfriend became my wife.
Chad, this is the Civil War all over again, but. It's a bizarre thing. All right, so we got the WCW fan, we got the frozen WWF fan, and we got me, who was sitting there, the lucky recipient of some tickets. So obviously, I was there live at the Fleet Center. Growing up in Boston, you know, I always had an affinity for that venue. Fun place to watch basketball, fun place to watch hockey, great place to watch wrestling. Overall impressions for you guys of the crowd, of the venue, because I know that's something Scott and Justin get into all the time on their show. What did you think of the Fleet Center? What did you think of how did we do? How did we do as a hot crowd or not? Aaron, what did you think?
I thought the crowd was great. I just watched this. I rewatched it last night. Like, you guys were popping for everything. It was just Ben screaming.
Yeah.
No, I thought you guys did a great job. Like, you were not a Hartford crowd. I'll tell you that right now.
Take that, Rosero. Chad, what'd you think? What'd you think of the Yankees you were seeing on your screen?
Very, very good crowd. I thought it fit the tone of the show. I do think there's some iconic pops. I think in a lot of ways this crowd's a little underrated. Rewatching the show, I was amazed at, like, we'll get to it, but the pop Stone Cold gets is absolutely huge and really kind of sets the stage for that match overall.
Yeah, I think touching on some of the stuff you said, Chad, I mean, it was definitely, you know, being Boston, being the Northeast, we were certainly a WWF stronghold. And as Scott and I talked a lot about in the first part, this was really the make-or-break turning point for the WWF. You know, WCW had been just running roughshod over it. This was the opening, and I do think the crowd felt a certain allegiance and a certain amount of propriety towards, you know what, if this is going to be the last chance the WWF has, we're going to try to help them out as much as we can. I will diverge for just a sec for my one, because this is really my one story. I basically sat in my seat the entire time, but the only kind of side story I have about being there live was, forget what match it was during, I want to say the Knicks tag or somewhere about then, two guys showed up in the kind of the entryway to my aisle. I was the, not the upper level, but the mid level.
And you start seeing a bunch of kids going over and stuff like that. And we looked around, and it was actually the Jackal and one other dude, just this big, muscly, long-haired guy, who were just watching the match, oddly, from that perspective. Of course, immediately, me and my friends were like, oh, man, maybe we'll go get the Jackal's autograph, trying to figure out who this other guy is. And a bunch of kids went up to try to get the Jackal's autograph. And the Jackal just could not get a bigger douche. He just kept waving them away, saying, hey, hey, go watch the match. And these are little kids. These are like, you know, couldn't have been more than like 9 or 10. The Jackal was just like, hey, hey, go watch the match. And the guy with him kind of seemed confused, kind of like looked like he wanted to sign autographs, but nobody knew who he was. And then we would learn not long after that that was Edge.
Oh.
So that was Edge and Jackal watching the matches together. Jackal just being a bit of a pill, but you know, he's Canadian. What do you expect?
Yeah, what do you expect? Yeah. You don't sign anything up here.
You guys are very leery of it, you know? You never know. After Montreal, I think everyone was paranoid.
Right. From that day forward, everything changed.
You don't want to, I was going to say you don't want to put your John Hancock on anything, but I don't know who your John Hancock is.
It's probably like Mackenzie King or something.
Yeah,
some stupid name like that.
John Francois Hancock. All right, so the opening match. Well, first of all, before we can get to the opening match, Stephen Graham, who was responsible for coming up with this whole WrestleMania Rewind idea.
He's not on this show?
He's not here, unless he's being very quiet. we didn't wait for him today.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He's got a very good point that the very first thing you saw on pay-per-view was the DX band opening things up with their heartfelt rendition of the national anthem. Aaron, what did you think of these guys? What did you think of the DX band? Was it weird having this kind of ragtag, gnarly-looking group of guys by the entranceway, and was it odd for them to kind of take over and do the thing, you know, that Rick Charles and Aretha Franklin and all these other big names had done?
Well, I think it's high time they finally got a classy act to do the anthem. That was a good change. No, absolutely not. Absolutely not, they don't fit. But I think it kind of fit with the whole theme of the show.
Right.
Just, like, failed or disgraced people.
Yes.
And I don't know, as for what they did on the show, they were great. They were all right. Like, I always liked that song. It was super hot, right? Like, I remember the first time they played it was at the Survivor Series. Like, it was like a promo, or maybe, I don't remember if it was wrong before, the first time I heard it was at the Survivor Series in the Molson Center. Yeah. And the place went fucking crazy for the song until they found out it was Shawn Michaels, and then and it was just not good after that. But yeah, so I don't know, I was happy to hear that.
You're talking about the DX theme, not the national anthem.
Yes, the DX theme. But yeah, but like that DX theme is so iconic that I think in a lot of ways they're forgiven for that national anthem.
Yeah.
But then again, I'm not American, so I don't know. I don't have that. I'm not offended by it anyway.
Right. Chad, what do you think?
I'm a pretty big critic, actually, of national anthems on the electric guitar. I don't know. Even the Jimi Hendrix Woodstock kind of iconic version doesn't really do a lot for me. I like Jimmy, right. But I mean this was fine. But I would say in the lower end of the either national anthem or American the Beautifuls that we've heard at WrestleMania.
I think I'm with Aaron just as far as I think he made a great point about it fit the show. Like any other show, it wouldn't make any sense. But here, when you're selling it on, you know, Mike Tyson and Jennifer Flowers and Pete Rose, like, I don't think a lot of people, they didn't, like they would today, come out and just outright say, like, hey, this is the link between all these people. They were, you know, they let you kind of put it together yourself. These are all disgraced former celebrities, so.
DX band is dressed like the stereotypical 1998 rock band too, like still a little bit of the grunge hangover attire, but then he's also had the hat, like rocking the hat, so it's a little bit of a mistaken identity in 1998 rock music overall, I'd say.
Absolutely. All right, so we open the show with a tag team battle royal. Now, the one thing you guys didn't get to see watching on VHS is I believe they started with, like, you know, pretty much everyone in the ring. I, of course, got to see every individual entrance and appreciate the full glory of, you know, like, Bradshaw and Steve Blackman coming out together.
How did you guys contain yourselves with all that excitement?
That was like, it was the type of thing where I was like, you're either going to kill the crowd right out the gate, or more likely just playing a bunch of entrances back to back is going to get us hyped up, which is what I think it did. It was really, you know, it was that extended tease. But yeah, I mean, it was a weird roster. The tag team division was not horrible in 1998, but it really was two or three teams. So putting together a 15-team battle royal, they really had to dig deep. You know, of course, we had the Double Nation of Domination team, Double Bariquas team, but then a lot of random acts. Chad, what did you think about the fact that they opened up with the tag team battle royal? It's the only battle royal that opened up besides four at WrestleMania, correct?
Yes. The only battle royal that opened the show. Not a terrible idea to get the tag teams out there, and we still at least had a tag team championship match ahead of time. I thought this was a fun opener. I mean, this match is basically used as a vehicle to reintroduce LOD.
Sure.
And that was nice, a nice moment, and I think the Boston crowd was right there with them for that, so that worked out well. But a couple of thoughts just with the participants here. I was very happy to see the Quebecers out there.
Yeah.
I didn't know if this was wedged in between their Amazing French Canadians run. I get lost on their timeline.
Yeah, this is post Amazing French Canadians.
Okay, yeah, so real late in their tenure, but still good to see them. Farouk, I thought, had fallen on pretty hard times because he was in the championship match, World Wrestling Federation championship match at the King of the Ring.
Sure.
And here he is just kind of in a throwaway nation tag team and fighting and bickering and all that. But then also Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson, the Rock and Roll Express, which I was really excited to see because I love – one thing that I love in WrestleMania history overall is if you're a fan of I'd say kind of a scholar of pro wrestling and international pro wrestling. WrestleMania has been host to some absolutely great wrestlers like Tenryu, who has a great reputation in Japan, an excellent worker, and he's in that throwaway tag in WrestleMania 7. And here's Ricky Morton, you know, which if you're a diehard old NWA fan, you know Ricky Morton's one of the best tag team wrestlers of all time, and here he is getting kind of a WrestleMania moment. So it's interesting that someone that I would probably rank Ricky Morton as, I don't know, maybe like a top 15 wrestler that's ever competed at a WrestleMania if you look at their entire career.
Wow.
And he's just kind of in this throwaway tag. So I enjoyed that. There's a couple of instances of that.
It's funny you mention that because up here it's like, obviously now I know who Ricky Morton is, but then it's like, who's the loser with NWA on the back of
Yeah, head? Yeah. I mean, they look terrible.
This old guy. Who's this old guy? We get him out of there.
As dated as they looked in 1998 with their Rock and Roll Express gear, which they still wear that to this day. Like, I saw a match of Robert Gibson last year, and he still had, like, the purple pants and, like, the bandanas tied around and all this. It's pretty sad now, but they're still going with it.
Chad, I got to ask you, as an NWA guy, how much of an affront was the new Midnight Express to you?
Glad you asked that.
Yeah, so this is one of the, like Cornette, I have a very love-hate relationship with in a lot of aspects. Him kind of going along with this and being the manager of Bombastic Bard and Bob and Bodacious Bart is really a travesty because you're taking one of the greatest tag teams of all time and putting a spark plug and somebody that gets knocked out by Butterbean next year in a tag team. And I mean, they got a rub here, which I was a little bit surprised about. But, yeah, definitely not in the lineage of the other Midnight Express teams, whether it's with Dennis Condrey or Stan Lane.
You know, it was funny. I actually remember reading PWI around this time, and they tried to, you know, always being kayfabe and all that stuff, which, you know, I love PWI, but they tried to spin it as this being some sort of blow-off to the Road Warriors Midnight Express feud from the late 80s.
They were like, oh, it was more satisfying for the Road Warriors to win over their old rivals.
Oh, yeah.
In the Midnight Express. Which, even, you know, even as a kid, I was like, that. I don't know who the Midnight Express is, but certainly I know
it's not,
that.
It's not it's that.
Not, yeah, it's not these guys. All right, let's talk about the LOD for a sec. Aaron, what did you think? Because the LOD had pretty much, you know, they spent latter part of 97, early part of 98, WWF basically convincing us, like, these guys are done, they're over the hill, forget about them. They re-debut here, new outfits, new gear, Sonny as their manager. What did you think of LOD 2000? Did you buy them as being rejuvenated, or did you see this as kind of the last gasp that it ended up being?
I was not happy. See them, like, I mean, like, I liked them back in the late 80s, early 90s, because even, like, that's how I found out about them was through PWI. Like, that's the one link we had up here. So I was like, wow, these guys look amazing, right? So they came to WWF, I liked them. But afterwards, like, we've just been through, like, the year-long feud with the Godwins on every goddamn pay-per-view, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I just could not anymore. Like, and it was very clear right from the start of that Battle Royal that they were winning.
Oh, yeah.
It's got to be, like, the least exciting collection of people ever in the history of Battle Royals.
Right.
And so when they came out, I don't know, I didn't really like how Sunny looked either. Like, I love Sunny, don't get me wrong, but I was just like, wow, they dressed her in, like, the least sexy thing they could find to put her in.
Well, she looked like a Mad Max extra, which was harkening back to the formation of the Road Warriors.
I guess, but then they're wearing hockey helmets?
Yeah.
It's very strange, the whole thing. And right away, too, in the match, they start feuding with, they start fighting the DOA, which I guess is like a window of things to come for the next year, but, like, I don't know. It just didn't do it for me at all.
Yeah, I mean, it was everything again. You know, live crowd, first match, it definitely popped us up huge to see these guys back together, but looking back in retrospect, I was like, I think it was just, too little, too late for these guys, unfortunately. Yeah. And this obviously wasn't the answer.
No, and I totally get why they would push them after, too, because when I was rewatching, I'm like, oh, I'm going to see the LOD, but the crowd went crazy for them. Like, and crazy for the win, too.
Yeah, and it would be kind of the theme of the night in a lot of ways for me, because I rewatched this a couple weeks ago. And the thing was, I can't even see it live and seeing it on tape are two very different things. And that is that this show, as I talked about with Scott, it is not a great wrestling show.
No.
The wrestling is not fantastic. The spectacle, even, is not that much. But the one thing they did really well, and I think you're starting to see some other creative voices besides Vince McMahon creep in here, is that every match on the show, and Chad, you mentioned earlier, so I'm interested to get your take on this, is that there was build to some degree behind everything. You know, obviously the Austin story had been going on for a while. The Undertaker-Kane story had been going on for almost a year. Some of the other matches were all that. But even something like this, the LOD thing dated back to the previous fall. Just the idea that they were falling apart and rejuvenating them. So there was, I think that bought a lot of the crowd goodwill. It's just like, these are things we've been waiting to see. We've been waiting to see the LOD back at full power because, you know, we thought they were done. So I think that had a lot to do with it. Chad, what did you think about, because you mentioned it earlier, just builds on this show, that it may have been, well, it may not have been the best WrestleMania of all time. I feel like it was one of the best built WrestleManias.
I would agree with that. I think it's certainly a show where the sum of the overall show is better than each individual part. I kind of liken it to like a really good album. Like a music album where maybe none of the songs are standout hits. I think this show, if we go down the card, there's probably only one match I'd consider above, if we want to give like star ratings, 3 stars. But beyond that, the show really flows together. It feels important. It kind of segues into each other well. And once you're finished, it was a very quick watch. I actually watched this in one string when I rewatched it, which is pretty rare these days where I can just watch something all the way through if it's not live. And it was very enjoyable to watch overall as a composition completed card. And I think the build for each match really built to that, where you did get a good conclusion with most of these matches that felt satisfactory to the viewer. It's a very happy-go-lucky show in a lot of ways.
All right, let's keep moving through the card, because obviously we could talk about this Battle Royal forever. Just obviously an endless source of material.
Like the stars in the sky.
Yeah. So many stars in the ring.
Yeah.
We went from there to a match I actually really enjoyed, and I thought was well-placed on the card to keep things going hot, and that was Takemichi Noku defending the light heavyweight title against Aguila. Real quick. The only thing that pissed me off was I was on the other side of the ring from where they kept going outside. So all I would see was them coming off the top rope, and I had no idea where they landed. Because we didn't have big screens at the time.
Or if they landed, they would
just fall. I would have to wait and see if they got back up. But real quick, thoughts on this match and thoughts on the direction of the light heavyweight division at this point. Was it already pretty much, you know, buried? Was it already pretty much, you know, this was their attempt to do the cruiserweight division, but without the necessary talent? Aaron, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you just nailed it. I think we had one great wrestler in Taka, and everybody else was just, meh. Like, and the problem was, too, I think, is no one else really wrestled in the cruiserweight style. Like, Brian Christopher is not a cruiserweight wrestler. Like, he fights like a mat-based main event-ish style, I guess. And it just doesn't translate well. So, like, when you contrast it with the WCW just looks so much better by comparison.
Like, yeah, it felt like...
Go ahead.
I felt like they had a bunch of... I don't even want to say a bunch, because I really only had, at any given time, like, three guys in the light heavyweight division. But it's like... Brian Christopher was almost supposed to be their Dean Malenko, except he's not as good as Dean Malenko. And he didn't have a bunch of really talented high flyers to play off of. So, yeah, it was hard.
It's got none of the credibility or talent of Dean Malenko.
Sure.
Yeah. And, I mean, even Aguila in this match, he's good, but you can tell he's not as good. Nowhere near on Taka's level. Like, even the smoothness is missing.
Right.
And it's a shame, because Taka's really good. Like, he's the one guy you would fit into that WCW Cruiserweight division and be like, wow, he could make an impact and a difference.
Yeah, that was the problem. They just didn't have the guys for Taka around. And you saw, you know, they made a go of it here. They would bring in guys like Pantera, guys like Aguila, who weren't bad, but the other thing was they had no staying power. They had no character.
It's like the Divas division today.
Sure.
It's like at any time there's like two or three, and you might care about one, but then it's, oh, on a pay-per-view, we won't put it on suddenly kind of thing, you know?
Right. Chad, I feel like this is a good topic for you. You're Mr. International, you're Mr. WCW with the cruiserweights. Yeah. What did you think of the light heavyweight division? What did you think of this match?
I honestly think the light heavyweight division is something they kind of threw together most of the time at the very end if they were composing a card. I don't think it was a very high priority. The WCW cruiserweight division overall and the cruiserweight matches, this is a separate talking point, but I think it's really interesting with that. Like, if you watch, I'm just finishing watching up all of 1997, both Raw, Nitro, international stuff, kind of the year as a whole. And it's kind of amazing, really, when you remember how few great, I guess, cruiserweight Nitro matches there really were. Like, there's certainly, I'd say, higher quality TV on wrestling on TV now than back then. And including the cruiserweights, but they really resonated well. I don't know if that was the characters or just the novelty of the maneuvers they were performing, but they really kind of resonated and kept with the viewers throughout all these years where you still look back fondly on some of the stuff. I mean, there's some great matches, don't get me wrong, but it's not like week in, week out they were having four-star, spot-fest heavy flying matches. A lot of it's kind of 3 minutes, we do our stuff, and then we leave for the NWO to come back out.
It was time filler.
Yeah, so Taka and Aguila here, I kind of got the same vibe. It was just for them to showcase their spots. Taka hit most of his spots well, looked pretty good. Aguila kind of hung with him, but seemed a little nervous. And it was a decent match, but not a lot of depth to it.
All right, I think we've said what we need to say about the light heavyweights. Good match, not an all-time classic, but, you know, to get there all. Something I think warrants a little more discussion is the next match, European title match, Triple H defending against Owen Hart. Specifically, Owen Hart was a very interesting case here. Scott and I talked a lot in the first part about Owen coming back after Montreal, being super hot, and for a while in the winter, the rumor, as I recall, was we might see Owen against Michaels in the main event of WrestleMania with Austin and Tyson doing something separate, which Scott and I both agreed would not have been a great idea. My view on it was this was always the plan. I think Owen was brought back, got a big initial pop. I don't think he was ever meant for the world title scene, unfortunately, for him. And, you know, in my opinion, as much as I love Owen Hart, I was never a big fan of babyface Owen Hart. I don't think this incarnation ever worked. People wanted... It was this weird thing where I think people felt bad for real-life events, and it was almost like a sympathy. Yeah, it was like a sympathy. Oh, well, we should cheer this guy. You know, he sucked there. His whole family's gone. But he just, you know, great wrestler. One of the best, but just so much more comfortable as a heel. So... But what did you guys think of him being kind of siphoned off of Shawn almost immediately, put in this feud with Triple H that I think we got the sense by WrestleMania that really it was a feud to put Triple H over. And it was, you know, really a chance to establish Triple H, particularly with Shawn on his way out the door, which we'll talk about later, give Triple H a chance to establish himself as a strong secondary champion and go over a hot babyface like Owen Hart. Aaron, what did you think of Owen's position on the card? Touch on this match briefly, and what did you think of the decision to basically showcase Triple H here?
Well, I think, number one, you hit a bunch of great points. We talked, he's not great as a face. It just didn't work. I think, too, he's kind of faded to be upper mid-card at max, you know, like maybe occasional run in the main event, but never champion kind of thing. There's a couple things that struck me watching this match. Number one, like, it's a nice contrast, and we'll get to the other match later, but if you look at how Owen Hart comes down to the ring and how Sable comes down to the ring, like, Owen Hart looks way too happy-to-go-lucky, like, coming down to the ring for this feud. Like, they basically humiliated him on TV for, like, what, 6 weeks now?
Yeah, no, he's terrible on TV.
Yeah, he's slapping hands and, like, it makes no sense. Whereas when Sable later comes down, she's like, I'm going to fucking kill Luna. Like, and that's kind of, I thought that set kind of a bad tone for the match right off the bat.
Yeah, I agree.
I do agree, too, that I think, and this could be a whole other talking point, too, and not for this podcast, though. But it's like, I don't feel the feud with Triple H did him any favors at all. In that, like, If the point was for Triple H to go over, it's cool, it's fine. Like, it makes sense based on where they're going. But the fact that they kind of treated him like shit up until the match, like, they made him look like a fool, they treated him like shit, he gets outsmarted in the match. Like, where do you go as a character from there? You know, like, there's nowhere to go but down. How can you take him seriously? And whereas if they had maybe put a bit more effort into making him look more dangerous or something beforehand, then not only would Owen look better, but I think Triple H would look better too, because then he beat someone of substance, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he nailed it, Aaron. And I think also it was weird that they took the title off of Owen. Everything they did with the European title leading up to this was bizarre.
He beat Goldust.
Exactly. Like, beats Goldust, loses it back. This was just a weird. I mean, you know what? Beyond that too, it was, as we said, you go through this card, it really is a card of kind of like oddball matches, like sideshow matches and brawls. Like, that's everything. You have the high-flying match, is kind of an extra thing. They tried to do a technical wrestling match here, and it kind of stuck out like a sore thumb on this card, on this night. What do you think, Jen?
I think, in a lot of ways, this is Owen Hart's last match as an upper mid-carder.
Right.
I don't think after this he really kind of reached the level that his career had reached before. I think this was the match that going back and looking at it didn't age the best as an individual match to me. I thought Triple H looked a little still wet behind the ears with the kind of style of match they were trying to portray, and then I hated the finish. I thought Slaughter looked like an absolute idiot. He gets completely punked out by China. Then China low blows Owen, who's for some reason just like standing over there instead of attacking Triple H. So I thought the finish made every face look really dumb. It did make Triple H and China look like a good team together, because she's handcuffed and can still be effective in the match. But I don't know. This one, to me, I kind of go looking at the card, and I hadn't watched this show in probably 5 or 6 years when I watched it, and I was kind of pegging this as a sleeper type match, because, like I said, in my 1997 stuff that I've watched, Triple H has progressed a good bit, and Owen in 97 had some great stuff that I hadn't watched in forever, like the Davey Boy Smith European title match from March of 1997 Raw.
Right.
So I was thinking, coming hot off the heels of the Montreal angle, Owen may be fired up, and Triple H would kind of take the next step up the progression ladder, and I didn't think it kind of came off that way to me.
It was a much better match on paper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Was anybody else shocked at the fact that China's chin was the same size as Sergeant Slaughter? I just had one thought for you guys about this match, and not that I'd ever want to take Foley out of what comes after this, like in the Over the Edge and Unforgiven, because I think he's perfect, but do you guys think at all Owen might have worked in that role if Austin would have worked with him, like back as a heel, even allied with Vince?
Interesting thought, man. I like you said, it's much easier to come up with fantasy booking scenarios around things that didn't work. So because the Foley stuff worked so well, I think it's hard to pigeonhole that. But I think there's something to what Chad was saying. I think really, that's sad, but I think Owen was kind of damaged goods at this point. They would have had the built-in angle of him just being like, look, you know, the whole if you can't beat him, join him type scenario.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think the other problem was Owen's style of wrestling was not as conducive to 1998 WWF.
All the guys he was good with were gone.
Sure, but you're also seeing, like, Owen was a great technical wrestler, but can you really name, even when he was wrestling against Bret, his brother, in, like, one of the most intense blood feuds of all time, where there is no doubt these guys hate each other. It was never a brawl. It was always
in each other's shoulders.
Exactly. It was always like a brilliant technical wrestling match. And the WWF was moving towards the Attitude Era main event style where you're doing brawls, and that's what made those Austin Foley matches so classic. So I don't know. I think Owen, unfortunately, was getting left behind in a lot of ways, but also just because of his style. Triple H was able to adapt to some degree. But Owen just didn't. I mean, Owen was always that great technical wrestler who I love watching, but yeah, he was starting to just not fit in so well in this new WWF. Chad, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's tragic knowing the end game, but
of course.
But Owen going to WCW, I think, would have been the best case scenario. Yeah. Honestly, he could have, I think, performed well with a variety of fresh opponents there that fit his style. And then if you want to look really long-term, you know, keep going, progressing, then back in 2001, I think that's when the style of WWF kind of reverts back to a style that would fit Owen better.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it's really sad overall, but I agree with you that it's tough to kind of, I think we're all in agreement, hard as a face is not very good, but it's tough to kind of say, well, if he turns heel, what to do with him, because you don't want to replace what happens with Dude Love. You have Kane and Undertaker ready-made feuds for Stone Cold for the summer, and then you have the ascension of The Rock, and you can't really have Owen join DX or anything like that. That'd be stupid. So it's really tough to kind of peg him in a spot.
In WCW, would Owen Hart have joined Harlem Heat?
I think anything Owen would have done in WCW would have been
awesome.
Entertaining. I mean, imagine Owen and Jericho as a team in 98.
There's a lot of good options that could have happened. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well said, Chad. All right, so alluding to the match that Aaron already brought up, we have the mixed tag match. We got Sable making her wrestling debut, teaming with Marvelous Mark Mero, against the artist formerly known as Goldust, who just, at this point, I don't even know. Teaming with Luna.
That's how I dress on a Friday night, Ben.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, you make it work.
I do me.
Yeah, you do you. At this point, Dustin, who knows where his head was at. Luna, his partner, you know, first mixed tag match at WrestleMania since WrestleMania 6, which also included a Rhodes. I like what you said earlier, Aaron, about, you know, Sable just come out and really sell this match. I think, you know, Sable gets a lot of shit in retrospect because we know kind of behind the scenes how she was behaving. But there's no question at this time, both in terms of the live crowd and in terms of the viewing audience, I think people were crazy excited to see Sable finally stand up for herself, see her get in the ring. The interesting thing about this match is she certainly gets a lot of credit for realistically doing very little. I think that's kind of the historic bent on it. But, you know, even rewatching the other day, I was like, you know, she gets in there and she really, not just the move she hits, but like Aaron was saying, the emotion she conveys. I think she did a good job in this match. Chad, what do you think of Sable's performance and the match as a whole?
So I think this is a match where if you kind of want to be a smart fan and break it down hold for hold, you know, it's not a very good match. But as an entertaining piece of business that was used to get Sable over, it did a perfect job. And I was tremendously entertained by this match. One, Mark Mero trying to act like a face when he's the most douchey guy in the world is always hilarious. But Sable, I think both you and Aaron touched on it. Her emotion is what really conveys and puts this match over, because she has such hate and kind of viciousness. And her giving the Sable bomb and stuff like that, to me, this, I think this is the most attractive Sable ever looked to me. Kind of this not vindictive, but out for revenge type woman with a kind of scorn look in her eye and really pissed off face, and Luna running scared from her, and Goldust was just a train wreck. But Sable, I really felt like if this was the coronation of Austin on the male side of things, this felt like Sable's as well, because she was super, super over. I think you can argue she was maybe the second most over person on the whole show.
I think you can argue that. I would love to have Steve Willey or someone unpack your psychosis as far as finding pissed off, vindictive Sable the most attractive.
Is that your type?
Yeah. I really want to talk to your wife about this, to be honest. Do you ever dress up in the long ponytail and just come in like furious and give you the Sable wand? Maybe that's not for this show.
His wife is my ex, so she was pretty vindictive. So.
Learned so much from this podcast. And hey, you know, let's give credit to the fact that let's not fall into the same trap that apparently the whole locker room fell into after, is that Luna had her work boots on. Luna made Sable look great.
No.
Luna was fantastic in this match. Aaron, what did you think of the match? You kind of let us know what you thought about Sable, but yeah, match overall.
Well, when I was reading over some of the talking points for this podcast, like one of the things was like how it contrasts to Savage and Rhodes at 6, right? And like I when I went into the match, I'm like, there's no way I'm gonna like this more than Savage and Rhodes at 6. And I kinda did, which kinda made me feel upset a bit. But like I just thought that, like, well, we touched on her being angry, like I think that's so important. Like what happens before and after the matches, to me, is just as important as what happens in the matches and the attitude that goes with it. Like, I felt her anger. I felt everything about her character. Now, she's not a good actress by any means, right? But she did a good job at selling this. And I actually think that Sable is a little bit forgotten and underrated by history as to how important a part of the show she is. Mm-hmm. Like, she's a Hall of Famer. Like, she's got to go in at some point. Like, she was so over this night. And the crowd goes nuts for the powerbomb. The crowd goes nuts for everything she does. So I don't know. I thought the match was a success on almost every level. Was it a technical masterpiece? Nope. No. But like Mark Mero, like you said, like him like pointing at her, like, you want me to tag her into the crowd, is hilarious considering how much he hates her at this point, right?
Yeah.
Goldust is just strange and weird and but it kind of works in this context, you know? And I don't know, I thought Sable did a great job. Like, I don't want to say I can't say enough good things about the match, because obviously if you want to pick it apart, you can.
Sure.
But it's a perfect representation of those characters. And one thing I wanted to mention from before, and I think is really important too, is you kept mentioning about build. Like, everything is weaved together.
Right.
Like, how they weave Goldust and Luna, and they all have ties to the upper matches too, you know? Like, everything is well written for this show. And that does nothing but help it. You know, like, this match without the writing beforehand and all the context is probably terrible. But you put that context in, and it's a great experience.
Yeah, great point, Aaron. I think that, you know, again, it's kind of a function of WWF realizing where they were as far as this might be their last shot to overtake WCW. So even the writers, the bookers, everyone was like, this needs to be the perfect show. It can't just be a bunch of matches thrown together. You would see the complete flip side of that a year later when they're dominating and they're just, you know, throwing out hardcore intercontinental title matches because, hey, everything works. But at this point, there's definitely a lot of forethought before everything.
Yeah, and it's cohesive. Like, it's cohesive. Like, one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, and then maybe there's a tie-in with something else, and it's perfect.
Definitely. Aaron talked about Sable being the second most over person on this card. Giving her a run for her money is The Rock. If this was Stone Cold's coming out party and Sable's coming out party, certainly The Rock has to be considered, if not, you know, in that mix and a close number three. And not just for his match. He had a match with Ken Shamrock. It was fine. It was quick. It was another Rock-Shamrock match. Their feud had been going on, it felt like, 3 years at this point. But he has that great interview with Jennifer Flowers, of all people, which is another nice throwback. To, again, WrestleMania 6, I guess, where Miss Elizabeth had that kind of sit-down interview.
They
had The Rock firing off these... Yeah, with Barrett. He had The Rock firing off these great lines about, you know, getting the homeless people off of his lawn and all this other stuff. Chad, how much... Was The Rock already basically a star at this point, or did WrestleMania 14, again, cement him even further as this guy's going to be the man?
I think... I mean, The Rock had been taking steady steps. I think the Stone Cold IC title feud was a big indicator that he could be someone, you know, like an upper mid-carder, and then his run in the Royal Rumble was the next step. This sort of long feud with Shamrock overall, and this match in particular, I think, was the next step. But then I would actually say he kind of became a made man, really, when he became the champion, which I think is odd. You may could point to the SummerSlam 98 ladder match, but The Rock really progressed throughout the year once he became a Nation of Domination member. And this match is really kind of not... Hardly nothing is about the actual match. It's kind of about the two characters and after the match with Shamrock refusing to break the ankle lock and him putting it on The Rock on the DX band stage, which I enjoyed, and The Rock going nuts. But The Rock is starting to really compose himself as a star, and you're starting to really feel like he's going to be a big player in the WWF for years to come.
Aaron, on the flip side, did this match do anything for Ken Shamrock? I mean, by the next month, he's back in a feud with the aforementioned Owen Hart, gets put on the shelf for a little while. Farouk, we talked about earlier, having fallen from grace, actually gets a nice moment here. I really like when Farouk comes out and refuses to help The Rock and waves him off.
Yeah, that was good.
That was hilarious. But does Shamrock kind of get the shaft here? Is it really, all right, we're working to, you know, get The Rock over, we're working to maybe get a last mileage out of Farouk. Even Jeff Jarrett gets to come out and introduce Jennifer Flowers, which was an interesting choice. I guess it was just to get him on the card. Where does Shamrock fit into the shuffle here? And also, any thoughts you have on the match and the surrounding moments?
Sure. Number one, I don't think it's the match that hurts Shamrock at all, because I don't think they could have. I think they didn't want him to be. They wanted Rock to be Intercontinental Champion forever. So they're not going to give him the title. But like after the feud with The Rock, it's like, there's no room for Shamrock at the top right now with Austin and Dude Love and Undertaker and Kane. There's just no room. So it's like they couldn't put him over any stronger in the match. He killed The Rock. Like, he just beat him within an inch of his life, right? So I don't think it's the match. I think it's the follow-up to the match.
Right, there's nowhere for him to go.
That's it. And I will, like, we were talking about the Triple H Owen Hart match. I think this match is the perfect contrast.
Mm.
Whereas, like, kind of everyone gets over from the match.
Yeah.
Like Shamrock is still just as strong. The Rock is still exactly, like, he gets over more as an entertaining guy, and he's still the champion you want to see get beat. So I think it's actually a very good little piece of business, this match.
Yeah, go ahead.
I will say this. Any time a heel is on a stretcher with his hands in the air, the match is good for me.
Yes.
Like, they cut back, and I think he's holding up the belt on the stretcher, which I love.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just a device they've used so many times, but I'll always pop for it. Like,
and Shamrock was getting a little bulletproof at this point in the sense that we'd seen him. It's funny to me in the course of a year how many matches Shamrock cost himself, but he never really suffered because of it, because that was his character, as he was just this psychopath.
Yeah, so, he always was the stronger of the two.
Sure.
Like, even when he fights Shawn Michaels at Degeneration X, he's beating him up for the whole match.
Chad, final thoughts on this before we move on?
Well, just quickly with Shamrock, I do, like, I hate dumb baby faces. That's one of my least favorite things in wrestling. Yeah. But I at least will say with Shamrock, they didn't make it into kind of, he's too dumb to kind of know, you know, like a Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Rick Steiner talking to Alex S. type of person. He's just somebody that works on one level, but then can snap and go to another level where he's just essentially seeing red and not really thinking about the consequences.
He had a reason to be dumb.
Yeah, yeah.
If you will.
Right.
It's not just he's dumb. He has an emotional problem.
Yeah, I can buy that much more. Yeah.
He never recovered from having dog food shoved in his face.
Oh God, yeah.
And he snapped, and it was never the same again.
That really was the turning point. That was his breaking point.
Get out of his way.
All right. So after that, we are starting to get to, you know, people think of this as a double main event card with the title match and Undertaker Kane, but I gotta say, for me, I thought the tag team title match between the New Age Outlaws and Chainsaw Charlie and Cactus Jack was almost the third main event in a way, just because of the sheer amount of time they devoted on Raw to it. Now, this was another match that, again, Scott and I talked in the first part, was built for months. It went all the way back to, like, December when the Outlaws first jumped Dude Love. Had a tremendous amount of build. They basically took, like, an hour out of Raw one time where they threw the dumpsters off the stage and injured Jack and Charlie. So this was a hot match going in. It was probably one of the ones I was most excited for. Obviously, this was kind of the match where, even though they're still calling him Chainsaw Charlie, they finally kind of say, fuck it, he's Terry Funk, because he doesn't wear the pantyhose. He just wears, like, the Funk t-shirt. But Chad, thoughts on the tag team title match, its importance, the match itself, and I guess let's talk a little bit about Terry Funk kind of being placed into this as Chainsaw Charlie, but really whatever you want to talk about.
Glad to see a tag team title match on a WrestleMania card this high up. I think that's a good thing. Chainsaw Charlie to me is something I honestly hate. I do not like it at all. Funk had just kind of came off his ECW title run. He'd in quotation marks, been retired by the Bret Hart match in September. So for him to be this Chainsaw Charlie character, which is essentially Funk, but took some of the characteristics of Funk that I think really make him as a character, and sort of hit him with the pantyhose and the suspenders, or made him more cartoony. So I was not a fan of that. This match overall, I thought, was a fairly good brawl. It's another match where if you just watch it, just this show only, and don't realize what happened the next night, it feels satisfactory. With the conclusion, now knowing what I do know about what happens the next night on Raw, I'm not as high on it. With the kind of hokey finish with the dumpster in the back or whatever. But I kind of have mixed feelings, I guess, overall, because it is a good match, and it was rightly positioned on the card, but I do have a pretty good hatred for Chainsaw Charlie. I think Cactus Jack would go on to bigger and better things very rapidly. And the New Age Outlaws as a team overall is a team I really struggle with in history and with current day WWE. So
why is that?
I'm not a big fan at all of the New Age Outlaws. Yeah.
Anything in particular, or you just don't jive with
it? I just think like they get. This is going to go into. I think they do have a little bit of the WWF bias, if you will, where if you look at them as a team overall, I think both their historical significance and their in-ring capabilities are overstretched. I mean, I certainly, to throw out a tag team, I don't think they're as good as the Fantastics in-ring by any stretch of the imagination. And
does anyone think they are?
Well, you just, when you hear like the overall tag teams in history, from very WWF heavy fans, I do think they're sort of slotted in that top 10,
right?
Kind of figure, and
but I don't think that's so much as I don't
think
that's
so more
much
significance,
right?
Yeah.
I do think they get overmatched as far as I mean, it was smart to put them together as a team. And it certainly worked better with them as a team to be the DX tag team, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I do think they served their place and were important through the whole Attitude Era. But they're always a team I really struggle with. I can't get invested in their matches. And I certainly don't think they should have had a world tag team title right. run in 2014. But that's another
story.
Well,
that's a whole other matter. But, I mean, I think the Outlaws' overall significance, I don't think anyone's ever going to argue they're better in the ring than the Fantastics or even, like, you know, the friggin' Killer Bees. But I think the thing is they caught lightning in a bottle at a time when WWF didn't really have any other tag teams. The thing that screws it, though, is it just so happened to be during, like, WWF's hottest period in 10 years. So because they were the top tag team during the Attitude Era, they get placed on those lists. Because I agree with you. I mean, they're not great in the ring. Great talkers. I don't think anyone can argue that. Road Dogg is a great talker.
Road Dogg, yeah.
And I think, you know, Billy did his thing. He had a good look. But, no, I think it was you saw right away when the Dudleys and the Hardys and Edge and Christian came in, they were shuffled off immediately. It was like, we don't need you guys anymore.
I will say this, though. Like, I mean, like, I'm not with you on the in-ring work. But is there a more... I don't know if this is a testament to the time frame, but is there a more over tag team in WWF history?
That's true.
Like, and that's got to count, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are much better workers than Hulk Hogan.
Right.
But he's the greatest wrestler of all time in a lot of people's eyes, you know?
Yeah.
Like I don't know. I don't know if the Dudleys had been in the exact same position the Outlaws were in 97, 98. I doubt they would have been as hot.
Yeah, they were the right team for the right time.
Yeah.
I think if you put the Outlaws into, like, 1995 WWF, they don't get over.
No.
Because they can't get over in that landscape. They needed specifically the Attitude Era parameters to get over.
Yeah.
So I think that's, you know, it comes back to a lot. It was really a right time, right place scenario, and, you know, good for them. But we're, of course, getting way off course. We'll talk about this some other time, Chad.
But this is our first, like, real tangent, so it's okay.
Yeah, no, good for us.
Yeah, I would take, just as a tag team I'll throw out there, I would take Legacy, Cody Rhodes, and Ted DiBiase over the New Age Outlaws any day of the week. Yeah.
Come on, Chad, come on.
Any day of the week.
Are you just talking about in the ring, though?
I really think, I mean, one, and this is a tangent of a tangent, but...
Yes.
Like, crowd reactions to me is something I've been on podcasts and discussed a lot.
Right.
Crowd to me is a very kind of low, I would say, parameter if I'm judging an overall worker.
Sure.
Because you have weird crowds. I mean, I thought the crowd in... Well, you have weird crowds. I don't think you can predict that. I know there's a couple school of thoughts where if it got over, it worked regardless,
yep.
Or the crowd's never wrong. I take a different stance from that. So that I do agree they were over, but I think almost everyone was over. I mean, Val Venus was insanely over for a time in 1998. So.
No, that's true. Everyone was over during the Attitude Era, and that's a testament to a lot of people. But
not Kurgan. Kurgan wasn't over.
Kurgan was over.
The Oddities had MSG rocking, man.
Exactly, man. He's right.
Is that the Oddities, or is that the Insane Clown Posse guy?
No, oh, man, going into that show.
Golga.
I think we need to bring back the Brad and Chad show to do an hour on.
Yeah, this is a big meta discussion, but I will say of all the people and
glad
characters,
you brought it up, though.
Well, of all the characters in the Attitude Era, the New Age Outlaws are kind of like my pet hate team and somebody that I just never really got. And I like Road Dogg a lot. I actually really like Road Dogg. I don't know.
New Age Outlaws. New Age Outlaws or Beaver Cleavage, Chad? Yeah. Come on.
What if it was Road Dogg and Bodacious Bart?
As Bodacious Bart?
Sure.
I really want to have like an hour-long argument with Aaron over how Hogan's a much better in-ring worker than both of them.
He is a good in-ring worker.
He's all right.
I've seen him do drop toe holds in Japan, man. Come on.
Hey, man, I'd say his selling alone...
Dude, nobody got up from that leg drop. You know how strong he is?
Yeah.
Sure. All right. I've
all said right, my so, tag team title match in the books.
Did we even talk 1 second about the match?
We talked for a second.
It's good enough.
It's a good match. I enjoyed it. I thought it was an intense match. I actually really liked the... Yeah, just to give some people some context, in case you weren't watching WWF of 1998, of what Chad was talking about... Cactus and Chainsaw 1, the object of the match is to put your opponents in a dumpster. Next night on Raw, you find out they put them in the wrong dumpster because there was an official dumpster that you were supposed to use. So they get stripped of the titles. Outlaws get the belts back, which was a little unsatisfactory. But to me, that doesn't take away from that final shot of Cactus and Chainsaw just looking happy as all hell that they won the titles. So yeah, I like this match.
Banging on the dumpster, just mumbling incoherently.
Yeah. I thought it was a fun match, and again, it fit in with everything we've been saying, with the build was great, and feel-good moment to end in a vacuum. Yeah. All right, we can't go any further without discussing Pete Rose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah!
Disgraced former baseball player in the Cincinnati Reds, comes out ostensibly just to be a ring announcer, and then just tears apart the Red Sox, which, as a native Bostonian, I can tell you, if you want nuclear heat, especially in 1998, I don't think it would be as big today. Yeah, you know, it might be as big today. we're weird about that. Ripped the Red Sox, ended up doing a tremendous job, just like an instant heel, and then comes out, gets tombstoned by Kane. Aaron, thoughts on Pete Rose? What do you contribute to the show? Did you see this coming? I want to know that. Did you expect this to happen in any way?
No. Like, I'm like, all right, Pete Rose is going to announce. And in the first words out of his mouth, last time we were here, we kicked your ass.
Oh, like, God.
Not even an introduction, not even, hey, you didn't show me respect. Just right away, fuck you, Boston. Like,
yeah.
I thought it was brilliant. And I don't know. Like, this will always be... one of my favorite WrestleMania things, like these guys go on to fight at 3 WrestleManias, basically.
Right.
Like, no one else does that. There's like Rock Austin, Triple H, Undertaker, Kane, Pete Rose in the pantheon of like WrestleMania.
Yeah, right there.
So I don't know. Like, it was great. He was great. He was funny. He was just an asshole. Which, like, why would he do that to the crowd? There's no reason.
And as far as live crowd reaction, like, you guys saw what the Pop Austin got or the Pop Sable got. No one elicited more of a reaction than Pete Rose dissing the Red Sox.
Well, how shocked were you guys when he started saying that?
Oh, my God. It took me a second to understand what was happening. Because the other thing you have to understand is if you're from Boston, even if you're not that big a baseball fan, there's just something in your DNA that when you hear those words, it's just like the reptile brain just flips, and you're suddenly like, I hate this guy. Like, I want him to die.
So, and is Pete Rose like, is he, because he got boos right away coming out. Is he like not liked in Boston for baseball too, or like, or is it just
the general? Really? Because I mean, they're a National League team, so we didn't, at that point, we didn't play them that much.
Yeah, that's right, you didn't care. Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't even, I don't know. It was very weird. Chad, your thoughts?
Pete Rose better on the mic than the New Age Outlaws.
Oh, so, man.
No, this is great. I think, too, Jerry Lawler gets crapped on a lot, deservedly so, for a lot of his commentary. But I loved him here, like his little sound bites after Pete would do an insult, like his little man, like, man, or whatever. It kind of fit. So this is a really cool, memorable moment from this.
Yeah, well, you gotta also understand, like, I think this year and a half run of Jerry Lawler is basically what won him goodwill for the next 15 years.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
this is the brief period when he was in his glory.
Decent, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, so we move on to the Undertaker-Kane match itself. Now, to me, the build for this match, this is what I like from a WrestleMania match. I am very, I don't even want to say old school, because old school WrestleManias didn't even always have this much build. A lot of times you just get stuff thrown together at the last second. But to me, the best WrestleMania matches are the ones that have at least 6 months of build. And a lot of that came out of this era. This goes all the way back to Paul Bearer getting a fireball thrown at him 11 months earlier, revealing Kane as Undertaker's secret brother. And then feuding back and forth. The WWF did a great job keeping this feud, no pun intended, hot. And the pun there would be that fire was involved heavily, guys.
Well done. Well done.
Thank you. I don't want anyone to think I wasn't being clever there. But yeah, they kept this feud hot. When Undertaker finally agreed to the match only a few weeks before this, you know, it was deafening. The match did not quite live up to the hype. I would be interested to hear you guys' take on, was it even possible for the in-ring product to live up to the hype here, or is it just a case of, you know, these guys are far better characters than they are workers? Chad, I want to go to you first. Thoughts on this match?
Really, really great build for the match. First off, this was before, it was, the storyline's always going to be a little goofy, but it was before we got to, you know, is Kane's penis burned in the fire, and just the complete nonsense that would come.
What do you go right there?
And, well, I mean, that's always like the banner moment in the whole Kane timeline that I can think of. But the actual in-ring work for this match, I like this match on rewatch. I thought it was a good kind of big man lumbering match. I really like the finishing stretch, and I think the kickouts of finisher moves is something that should be used gingerly. It's something, yes. I think that's been overblown a little bit in recent WrestleMania main events. Rock and John Cena, I'm looking at you. But this one I thought really played up well. One, because the Tombstone was such a protected finisher for The Undertaker up to this point. And two, Kane's kick out was not a very aggressive kick out. I love his kick out where he just kind of barely moves his shoulders to kind of kick out. And Undertaker's always been able to really sell kind of his disbelief from that and really showed some vulnerability that you weren't used to seeing from him. So as a semi-main event match, you know, not going to be a 4-star classic in ring wise, but I thought it was very well booked and very well built upon, and I thought they both tried to have a very good match together, and I enjoyed it.
Aaron, who are you?
Just to echo, great build, stuff like that. I got to be honest, like from 1992 to 2007, with a few notable exceptions, I was never happy to see an Undertaker match. Like, I just hated how slow they were in general. I feel similar to Bret Hart as well, but, like, it did feel super epic. And I think that was kind of the point. Like, it felt almost like the most important match on the show. And if you take out the in-ring product for me, I thought everything went off pretty much without a hitch. But the match itself, even rewatching it, I found it a bit, it's not to shit on their effort at all. I think they did great for what they had, but I'm just not interested in that match. But the story and everything else, fantastic.
Yeah, certainly not a fast-paced match.
No, and, but you're bang on with the kickouts, though. That was awesome. Like, the barely getting the shoulder up. Right. I love that stuff. And even when he almost kicks out of the third one, like, it's just like that second late.
Yep.
Like, those are the touches I love about matches.
Let me throw this one at you guys, because this is something that I think Steven brought up, and something interesting. Like, you know, the lore around this match was always that this was supposed to be a limited run angle, and this was supposed to basically be the end of Kane. You know, he'd come in, work a few months with The Undertaker, and then he'd get beat, and he'd be gone. Now, of course, that would not be the case.
No.
He'd keep beating The Undertaker, and then he'd be coming in during character to the point where, you know, 16 years later, Kane is still running strong. He's been through a bunch of incarnations. If Kane had ended here, do you think that would give this match more historical significance, or do you think they would have been leaving money at the table? Aaron, what do you think about Kane as a character and his, you know, his legs come out of this match?
I think if they would have ended it here, Kane would have been in the same sentence as, like, John Gonzalez. Like, he just would have been nothing. Instead, he became this awesome character, right? I mean, what other wrestler has a novelization of his life written by the WWF, right? And I don't know, like, as much as they've had the Kane's had his kind of share of horrible story ideas and whatnot, but, like, I don't know, he's like the guy that makes you feel safe. He's the guy who's always there. Like, he's almost reassuring to see. Like, I don't know, he's a great character, and I'm glad they didn't end it there.
Yeah, and he really did. You know what, the nice thing is, The Undertaker, at this point, he'd been going on almost a decade, he'd been going on 8 years, and he really kind of stood alone as kind of this, the WWE's one weird off-to-the-side character. I think Kane, beyond just being a great character in his own right, probably gave The Undertaker character some longevity, just in the sense, you could always tie him to the rest of the WWF. The Undertaker, for so long, was off in his own little corner, just fighting whatever monster heel came in. I think the introduction of Kane and the longevity of Kane, you know, whether you have them as a team, whether you have them feuding again, just the fact that this other guy from Undertaker's world, so to say, is in the WWF and is not going away, I think really helped the Undertaker character. What do you think, Chad?
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't think if this was it for Kane, he'd have been very memorable. Probably would have been the best of, like, the Undertaker's short run feuds, but him kind of sticking out, they it's always kind of something that they can go back on. Even when they feuded about 3 years ago, they could still bring up the history of these two, as convoluted as it has become. And it did give The Undertaker, in some ways, it's kind of weird to say that he got more legitimacy with Kane, but I think he did in a little bit, because I do think some fans were like Aaron that saw The Undertaker just in these very supernatural type feuds and these slow matches, and he had some bumps in the road, but he parlayed this feud into the feud with Austin that I think was very successful, both from a market and an in-ring standpoint. So kudos to Kane for that.
Yeah, and when you talk about legitimacy too, like, I think it's really interesting, because it's almost like the feud with Kane kind of ties The Undertaker back to the rest of the WWF picture.
Yep, agree.
Like, it's kind of through the feud with Kane that he gets back into the WWF title picture, and whereas, like, for the past 5 years, like, with the exception of his title run, he's been just separate.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Bret Hart's defending the title, but Undertaker's fighting Kamala, and there's nothing that bridges that, you know?
Right.
This ties it in.
300%. All right, so we got one match left. You know, before we even get to that match, you know, one thing I think is interesting about this show that kind of makes it stand out, that you don't see nowadays, you didn't see before, usually between, you know, the semi-main and the main event, you have some sort of cool-down match, whether it's a Divas match, whether it's a quickie match, something like that. This show really was, you know, bang, bang, bang. Like, they got the fluff out of the way early. I think, like, probably the light heavyweight title match was really the only thing you could kind of, like, wedge in here later. But they went right from Undertaker Kane to the main event here. We didn't even have, like, you know, unless I'm remembering wrong, they didn't even have, like a segment with celebrities or anything like that. They went
right away.
Yeah. So that's definitely unique. not really anything to talk about, just an observation.
Right.
But so we got Austin and Michaels, and a lot of what Scott and I talked about in the first part of the show was Austin, Michaels, Tyson, the doubt of Michaels making it to this main event, and just the fact that we hadn't seen him on TV a whole lot. He'd been on and off. He was dealing with injuries. He was dealing with personal demons. It was really a lot on Austin to build the feud. And to me, this match wasn't even so much Steve Austin versus Shawn Michaels. It was, can Steve Austin win the WWF title finally? I think for those of us who were, you know, a little on the inside, we had no doubt he was coming out of it. But really, the story of the match was Stone Cold Steve Austin's final moment with a little bit of what is Mike Tyson going to do? Is he going to get into it with Austin? Is he going to, you know, try to cost him a match? Shawn Michaels was almost ancillary to me at this point. And, you know, to be fair, he had made himself that way. And I think he's admitted that on DVDs in the past. But as far as the setup of this match, before we get into the match itself, Chad, what did you think this match was about? Was it a strong feud between Michaels and Austin? Did that even matter?
I mean, to me, again, being the WWF as my secondary promotion, to me, the main issue always felt more between Austin and Tyson and just their dynamic, and then just kind of Austin kind of finally, hopefully, realizing his moment and becoming the champion for the first time, which is something that's very kind of underrated now. If you look back at the WrestleManias since WrestleMania 14, there's not a lot of kind of first-time champions that have been crowned. Really, kind of Cena, Batista is the last one that jumps to mind. So this was sort of the end of that. But I didn't really get a sense of, I would say, a blood feud necessarily between Michaels and Austin, the two wrestlers in the match.
Aaron, what did you think about the setup of this match? What were you most intrigued by going into? Obviously, you were watching it through Scramble Vision, but you're still watching.
Yeah. Well, number one, I think that WWF did a great job of portraying the DX / New Age Outlaws somewhat alliance. I think that was the closest thing they had in terms of a stable of, like, thugs. Like, when they would beat you up, they would beat you up. Like, not to put them on par with the Horsemen, obviously, but I just feel that, like, most WWF stables didn't have that. And some of the beatdowns they gave Austin were great. Another thing, up here in Canada, like, Michaels was the guy that screwed Brett, right? So to us, like, as much as, like, I mean, everyone loved Bret Hart, but everybody loved Steve Austin, too, right? So in that feud, it was kind of who you did cheer for. But now, like, not only is it Austin winning the belt for the first time, but it's Michaels getting his comeuppance. Right. And for us, that was extremely an extremely huge part of the storyline. And then you got the whole Vince stuff, too, which I think is great, too, where he's like, I don't want him to be champion, and it's a nice little bit of foreshadowing.
Interesting, but they don't go to that on this show at all. Right. They don't mention Vince. I mean, they mentioned it briefly in the commentary, I think, but, you know, he's not there.
No, and with all the video packages with it, too, you'd think that there'd be one little bit of it. But, the heat that, up in Canada, the heat that Michaels had from Survivor Series was crazy. Like, just crazy, right? So that was a huge part of the story for us.
Now, as a guy who is, you know, Shawn Michaels is my favorite wrestler of all time, just purely from in-ring, also from, you know, charisma and all that stuff.
Being a dick like you are. So.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
Jeez, is this what we're doing now? We're turning on each other?
No, Chad turned on me a while ago. He's just been civil this whole podcast, and I've got to give him credit for it.
It's like a wild card match where we're not fighting each other yet.
No.
Standing on the apron, being good.
Chad was waiting. He waited over an hour. I mean, that's impressive. But no, I mean, the thing with Michaels, I've been watching his Mr. WrestleMania DVD compilation, and he never has bad matches at WrestleMania, except, I would argue, this match. I think that's part, and it's all on him, in my mind. Austin's game to go. Michaels, and it's not totally Michaels' fault, I think he's injured beyond belief. His back is out of it, but he's also out of it, too. Personally, and I want to get you guys' take, but personally, I just thought this was Shawn Michaels' weakest match. I think in-ring is just good. I think there's, you know, a lot of instances where they're just, they're fumbling with each other because Michaels doesn't know what he's doing. He's not as crisp. And, you know, his big regret is that, and he says this on the DVD, I talked about this with Scott in the first part, is he said this was his biggest professional regret was this match, not being able to put Austin over stronger. Although, as he notes, not that Austin needed it in any way.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of the match quality? We haven't talked that much about match quality on this show, but I think this is the one match where I'm very curious to think if you thought this was a good in-ring match or not. Chad, what did you think?
First off, this one's for you, Earl. And then secondly, as far as an in-ring match, I really like their match at King of the Ring 97.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting kind of snapshot type match right before Austin has the neck injury and Michaels was kind of coming off finding his smile again or whatever. And they
I was there for that one too.
Oh, really? You're at King of the Ring 97?
I was.
Did you cross paths with Justin?
Maybe. I mean, we didn't know.
That'd be really weird if y'all did.
I think it was one of, yeah, it's one of those, like, hidden moments.
Like cosmic were, encounters.
Yeah, I just, like, shoved him or something. We didn't realize it.
but coming out of that match, it really felt like they could have had an all-time classic to me in ring. I felt that match was kind of flirting with it. Just rewatched the King of the Ring one a couple months ago and had it over 4 stars. So this match, I do think it's a good match, though. I would say good. I would say a good match. I think Michaels is a guy I'm usually lower than most as far as an overall in-ring worker. You know, like, as he wouldn't be my top favorite wrestler of all time. Probably not even a top 10 for me. Very safely, not a top 10 for me, but I do have
well,
to give.
I think Ric Flair sucks.
Well, that's incorrect, sir. That is incorrect.
Your opinion is incorrect, my friend.
Well, you were reading comics, Thunderlips. He was winning world titles. I give Sean a lot of credit in this match, and I think they tried to have as much, I would say, distractions and stuff as possible to kind of keep the match moving along as far as what they did with Tyson, and Sean would kind of regroup on the floor and kind of move around. So there was a lot of action without any action, if that makes sense. They did some kind of Memphis stall tactics in this match. And once Sean has the corner bump that's really kind of the end for his injury-wise, you can certainly tell the match from that point on is him just trying to make it to the end. But I enjoyed it. I don't think, I guess I'm trying to think of what I would say would be a worse Shawn Michaels WrestleMania match. Nothing's coming to mind right offhand, but I still thought this was a good match.
That's because all his WrestleMania
well, Tatanka, awesome. But you know, I mean.
Yeah, that was a decent match.
El Matador. I will have this safely above those two. But otherwise,
you gotta rewatch them, man. Rewatch them.
Gotta rewatch that WrestleMania 9.
What'd you think of the match itself?
Let me preface this too by saying that, like, I'm like you, Ben. Like, I don't know if he's maybe Savage I like more than him, but he's up there for me. Like, I was the one guy in Montreal the night of the screw job cheering for Michaels.
I can't believe you made it out alive.
Until I realized, well, no one knew what the hell was going on, so the confusion saved me.
Yeah.
But because we don't have the commentary, right? It's like, what the fuck? He's smashing everything. Anyway, it was such a weird night. I'm probably a very opposite to most of the internet wrestling people because, like, I rarely ever look at matches as, like, this is a 5-star match, this is a 4-star match. Like, for me, the match is only, I look at it in terms of total experience. Mm-hmm. You get what I mean?
Yep.
Like Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, Hulk Hogan doesn't have to be doing moonsaults for me to think it's a 5-star experience. You get what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah.
Like, and so the build to this match, the match itself I thought was, I think maybe, like, I probably like it a bit more than you, Ben. Like, I thought it was good. Like, I thought it was fine. Like, but with everything that went into it, I thought the whole experience was great. Like, I think what you guys are saying right is that it was a little ancillary that it was Shawn Michaels as the champion. like, especially with Austin going for the title, like, his natural opponent always seemed to be Bret Hart, so it was kind of like, okay, well, is Austin going to win the belt? But I think Michaels' heel work up until this match really helped make the match. Like, number one, like, Michaels' entrance to this match is, I don't know if anybody gets off on entrances like I do, but, like, that was, like, he never looked, in my eyes, more legitimate as a heel champion than he did in that entrance. Like, everything seemed like a big deal. Like, this was the guy. Right. And I don't think he ever looked like that before. Even when he won the title at 12, like he just came out looking like a superstar. And I think that his heel work, and it's too bad it's so short, his heel work from, I say, about, like, October 97 till this match is pretty underrated in general. Like, there's probably a case to be made that he's in, I don't know, like, very high territory for heel work of all time.
He was born to play that heel character. Like, yeah, it fits him so well.
Yeah.
And he was just unleashed in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was just a fucking asshole, like, on every level.
Yeah, yeah. Completely just an obnoxious prick that you want to punch right in the face. Yeah.
Yeah. But could back it up. Like, he still went into that Hell in the Cell with The Undertaker. Like, he got his ass kicked, but he still went into it, you know?
Right, he was hung in there.
Well, yeah, a little overconfident in his own... Still, like, overconfident in himself, too. I think that's the key. Like, in that Undertaker Hell in the Cell match, he, you know, he acts scared, but as soon as he gets a little bit of offense, he gets a little cocky in his abilities. But the first chance he sees where the cameraman gets escorted out, he tries to escape like the bitch he is.
Yeah.
So, very great.
Yeah, so I don't know. The match itself, I actually, again, like, I watched it last night. I enjoyed it. And I was very tired, so, like, I was able to... It actually woke me up a little bit, so...
Nice. All right, interesting viewpoints. All right, let's kind of go to the end, where we get Mike Tyson turning... It was an interesting turn, because he didn't, like, you know... He didn't cost Michaels the match, which I think was important. Austin needed to win it on his own.
I agree.
But Tyson, who was the outside enforcer, comes in and counts the three count. That gives Austin the title. The actual referee was knocked out. And we have the bit after the match where Tyson knocks Michaels out. And then Austin gets to have his big celebration. Two questions for you guys. Start with Aaron. What did you think of Tyson's role, particularly since this WrestleMania was just, in so many ways, you know, the mainstream publicity and everything else was sold on Mike Tyson. Was his role satisfactory to you in the end? And also... Given how long people have been waiting to see Steve Austin as champion, and Chad made a great point about it, he was really one of the last kind of, we're going to wait until WrestleMania to give these guys the titles. Did he get the WrestleMania moment you wanted to see out of him?
I thought Tyson's appearance was a bit more subdued than I was expecting, but I don't think he should have or could have done any more than he did. You know what I mean? Like, I like him as the enforcer. I thought it was fine. It's like, in some ways, like, I wish he could have been more involved in the match, but I don't think he could have, so I'm happy with it. And aside from the extremely quick three count, I think he did a good job. He was a good tease throughout. I thought it worked well. As for Austin's moment, I thought it was kind of exactly how it needed to be. I think the only thing that could have made it possibly better, and again, this is just hindsight, is I think if it was over Bret Hart, I think it would have meant a little bit more, because that was kind of his forever rival, but
yeah,
that wasn't possible, so Michaels is the next best thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and just as a quick aside, you know, they rumored, of course, that Tyson was going to be in the match, which to me, I never thought was going to happen. I'm glad we didn't see it. It was always very weird to me that it was, what, 12 some odd years later, when they had that DX against Jericho and Tyson match on Raw. You guys remember that one?
Yes.
Like, this throwaway tag match, but it's like, oh, well, now we're getting to see Tyson in the ring.
Finally.
And he actually wrestled. It's very weird to me.
Well, and the thing with putting Tyson in the match is, like, it's like, I'm all good for stretching my believability, but, like, how can anyone beat him?
Yeah, sure.
It's like, I almost feel that way sometimes watching Ken Shamrock matches. Like, who's going to kill this guy?
They should have had him face Shamrock.
At least that would have been believable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or had him face Roddy Piper.
Or Bart Gunn.
Or Bart Gunn. Yes.
Yes.
That would have been amazing. All right, Chad, same question to you. Tyson's involvement and also Austin's big moment. Did both live up to the hype? Did both satisfy you?
Tyson, I agree that he was... I did get the kind of... I'm a big fan of Floyd Mayweather's match with Big Show at WrestleMania 24 and the way he presented himself throughout that match. So I didn't get quite the same aura from Tyson coming out here, but I thought he did fine. He got his role. He threw the punch to knock out Michaels, and he was okay. And it meant a lot for him to be on this show. Austin's big moment, I thought, was huge, and... very interesting, kind of, to go back to an astute point I made earlier, where...
God knows you're going to, yeah.
Where we haven't had kind of that big coronation moment in a while at WrestleMania, and I think, to use a modern-day perspective, we're coming up on one with WrestleMania 30, where Daniel Bryan has won the belt before, but this feels like his coming-out moment. And Austin, in this show, it really felt like that, but... I think the most critical thing about Austin from this era was now that he was the guy, he had a ready-made. They had a ready-made feud for him versus Vince. I think that's kind of understated, that they had kind of been, Vince had been slowly been kind of tinkling in the stuff where he'd been stunnered at MSG, and we had the Brett Screwed Brett promo, and he didn't want Austin as champ. But right after this moment, it really went into overdrive. And that's the type of thing where now, with this year's WrestleMania, we're going to hypothetically kind of have the culmination of one feud. And it'll be interested to see if they are able to have that linchpin new feud ready for Daniel Bryan to kind of carry the momentum. Because as great as this moment was, I think if WrestleMania 14, if Austin would have been stuck in a feud... with whomever, you know, like a secondary feud with Triple H or something like that, of another DX member, I think they had built enough momentum that it was inevitable they were going to overtake WCW at this point. But I do think there'd have been a little more peril with the rise of Goldberg and other stuff. So I think having the Vince-Austin feud in their back pocket at this moment was really the most... the smartest thing they did, because to use the WCW's perspective, after Sting Hogan at Starrcade and that mess, they didn't know where to go. They really had nowhere to go and sort of lucked into the Goldberg thing 6 months later, but by that time a lot of damage had been done. So kudos to the WWF having this ready to go right after the big shining moment.
It sticks in your craw, doesn't it? WCW boy.
That's another podcast for another day. But that's
a bitter pill for you to swallow.
That's one of the most. I mean, it's the beginning of the end. I mean, it's there's a lot of kind of symmetry with how the Starrcade '97 match ended compared to how this match ended, and how right everything with this match sort of felt from a character standpoint, and how wrong everything felt with that Starrcade 97 main event. So,
Chad, do you hate Steve Austin as much as you hate Abraham Lincoln? you can take the fifth. Aaron, what were you going to say?
Oh, no, it's nowhere near as good as your Abraham Lincoln stuff, so just go on.
All right, show's wrapped up. Guys, I think that was great. Let's get some quick final thoughts. Aaron, importance of this WrestleMania, how does it rank for you all time, and just any concluding little nuggets you have to share?
I think it's a middle-of-the-road WrestleMania, like in terms of me rewatching it. In terms of importance, I think it's hugely important. It's probably in terms of importance, it's probably top five, because it launches and sets up everything that's eventually going to put the WWF over as the winning company and the better company. They're better, because when you have a tag team like the New Age Outlaws, they're just better than any WCW tag team ever. So you can see that right away.
Throwing gasoline on the fire. Chad, final thoughts.
I mean, as far as important shows overall in WWF history up to this point, WrestleMania 1 and WrestleMania 3 is the only two that kind of come to mind for me. that eclipse this one. As far as an overall quality standpoint, I think it's a very good show, top to bottom. And it I think where it is in the lineage of WrestleManias, in some ways helps it, because you had WrestleMania 11, 12, and 13 right before it, which each had a really good match on those shows, but is surrounded by some pretty blah stuff overall. And then after this, you have the mess that is WrestleMania 15 and WrestleMania 2000. So this show's kind of sandwiched in between that and is a very good top-to-bottom show, kind of like a B-plus show overall, but when you add the historical significance on it, I think it's a good watch and really fun to go back on and kind of, even if you don't have memories of the era, of this era overall as a whole, if you're a newer fan, it's kind of like this is the birth of the rock and wrestling era for me. Like when I would go back and watch Hogan rise up the ranks, you get the same here with Austin.
Yeah, and do you think that there's been a WrestleMania that's happened since then that has equal historical significance?
Tough. I think 17 was important, but more kind of as a culmination or celebration.
Yeah.
So I don't. And then if you want to argue like WrestleMania 19 is the end of the Attitude Era, so to speak, that's but since the end, I can't really think of one overall that has this this type of magnitude. So
I think the ones Chad mentioned were historical in the sense of they came at a pivotal time in history, or they were just good.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think there's never been as much on the line.
Right.
WWF hasn't been in peril the way they were in 1, 3, and 14, where it's like, if this show doesn't succeed, we could be in trouble.
Agree.
Yeah, and it's like, if you look at, like, maybe even 21, where, like, they're kind of, like, crowning Batista and Cena.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Like, they don't crown them to the same level they crown, like, Austin Rock, you know,
sure.
DX going forward. And yeah.
Good points all around, guys. Chad, what was the one good match at WrestleMania 11?
Michaels and Diesel, I think, is a very good match.
It was a good match. Yeah, fair enough. Guys, this was a blast. We went longer than expected, but that didn't really surprise me because I had a good conversation. And it was really, really a fun time talking to you. You know, when the Brad and Chad show comes back, maybe this could be the new lineup. Chad? I don't know. Yeah, all right. Eric George, Chad
rejection.
Campbell. What?
It's an outright rejection of that idea.
Yeah, outright rejection. He's committed to Brad, which I admire. Aaron George, Chad Cable, thank you guys so much. Scott Criscolo joining during the first part. Hope you guys out there enjoyed this WrestleMania Rewind look at WrestleMania 14. Big show's coming up in New Orleans. I'm going to be there. Chad's going to be there.
Yep.
Aaron, I don't know where you're going to be, but you'll be in our hearts. And, of course, there's going to be a lot of great WrestleMania content between now and then on PlaceToBeNation.com. So please do tune in. And thank you guys for listening. I am Ben Morse for Chad, for Aaron, for Scott. I don't think we have a sign-off line for these podcasts. So I'm just going to say thanks for listening. And we'll see you guys again soon.